Welcome to the current federal tax developments for the week of November the 25th, 2019. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and your State Society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and this week we're going to be looking at a few developments. We have the IRS talking about security issues for information that tax preparers may have under their control. The IRS adds more questions, though this time not quite as nasty in the result as we had last time, to the frequently asked questions on Section 199 Cap A. We have the IRS dealing with an issue of the clawback for the issue of the gift and estate tax rules, where the exemption goes back down to 2026. In this case, we're looking at the IRS finalizing regulations they issued last year that attempt to prevent a clawback problem from occurring. And finally, the IRS finds that they're not going to be allowed to apply two separate penalties to a taxpayer who failed to file a Form 3520. And more importantly, the penalty they are going to apply will be 5% of nothing. So that's probably not a good result from the services perspective. So let's talk about what's coming up. I do have some online courses coming up. I'm doing a lot of in-house sessions. I want to remind you that if you want to have us come out and do a tax update session or any other topic that we cover in your office, you can do so. You can arrange that with your state society or with us here at Kaplan. You can do those sorts of things. We'll be out and do it. And I do a number of those coming up here for the next few weeks. But I do have some broadcast sessions that are available generally. One coming up on this week, the 26th, if you're listening to it before Tuesday, 199 Cap A Explained, Planning for Qualified Business Income. That will be a webcast. It will start both at 6 a.m. and 8 a.m. Pacific. All of these California courses go at that time. Coming up later in the year on December 12th, Partnership Taxation Advanced Issues. Again, 6 a.m. and 8 a.m. Pick your time for start. And I'll also have coming up Multi-State Taxation of Businesses. We'll have a number of others coming up, but those are the ones right now. Many state societies list these in their catalog, so you can sign up through your state society site. If not, you can go to CalCPA and sign up on their site on these dates for these courses. Well, let's talk about what's happening here with preparer information security issues. There's been a lot of discussion about that recently. The IRS has put out a lot more notices. And in this case, we have an article that was in Tax Notes Today. It was reporting about a conference that took place in North Haven, Connecticut. It was a New England IRS representation conference. And this was some IRS presentations on issues related to information security and preparers. One thing they discussed at the conference, this was brought up by Margaret Romanilio, who is the area manager for the IRS Stakeholder Liaison Division, talks about cases the IRS have seen this year where intruders have gone into a preparer's network, sat there quietly, then gone in and looked for returns that were about ready to be transmitted to the IRS. You know those. You finish the return. You've got the electronic filing document ready to go. You've now sent it to the client. They're reviewing the return. They're going to sign that document and return it to you. When they return that document to you, you will then submit the return to the IRS. Well, the intruders find those files, and then they go and they simply change the bank account routing information, and they change it to a prepaid debit card. Presumably, you won't notice when that signed form comes in. You'll just release the return, and at that point, the return goes in. Everything looks great because it's actually the real information for the taxpayer. The only thing that's going to happen that's different is they're going to end up having the refund not go to the taxpayer, but go to that prepaid debit card. And by the time anybody figures out this has happened, well, the perpetrators are long gone, and it's going to be tough finding them. The other option that was noted is sometimes if they're a little bit, let's say, less patient, they might actually go in and find returns and just go ahead and change the account and then do the submission. That's also been known to happen. That one you're more likely to notice because, of course, the file's already been submitted. And that you probably notice as soon as you came back in and said, wait a minute, how'd this get submitted? That might clue you in if all the returns you had queued up for submission had somehow magically gotten submitted. Of course, I guess you probably spent a little bit of time with a back and forth in the office trying to figure out, you know, who made the mistake and sent all the returns up. But you might figure out something was happening quicker. So this is more than a little scary. They did note in the conference that the number of returns or the number of cases they've had are down somewhat this year. There were about 100, you know, a little over 100 cases of preparers having their systems infiltrated. But they did note that was reported cases, not necessarily the actual cases took place. I should remind you that, and I should have mentioned, that this particular description came from an article by Nathan Richmond, Tax Hackers Coming Up with New Tax Traps, New Traps, I should say, for the Unwary. It was in Tax Notes Today on November the 22nd. That article went on to describe a gentleman who spoke at the conference who was a preparer that had an actual breach in 2013. In his case, they had gotten in, gotten to information. The one problem he ran into is that even though he only lost 10 clients over this breach and he had to notify all clients, he had to take a number of steps which were complicated. And why were they complicated? Well, because like a lot of us, this gentleman had clients who actually were in multiple states. And by the time he was done, he had to deal with 40 different state rules that related to this issue. In general, when there's been a data breach, you're going to have to provide some sort of credit monitoring, but the exact nature of that monitoring is going to be different with each of the states involved. So you have to check the rules for all the states. That can complicate matters. He also had a second problem, and this is one you better realize is going to be bigger. You don't just have information in your files about your clients. You have personally identifiable information in your file about a lot of non-clients that relate to work you're doing for clients. For instance, a CPA firm likely would have, if they do any payroll work for a client, they'd have information on the employees, all the information, personally identifiable information on the employees for the year. That would be on the system. Even though those employees are not your client, you just lost their information. And the state rules are going to make you responsible for giving them protection and notifying them that their records got lost and hacked and stolen. We also have information about employees, vendors, and customers of a client if we do a test work like audits. We may have a lot of information in the files about that type of information. If we do any pass-through entities, partnerships, S-corporations, trusts, estates, we're going to probably have the identifying information for the equity holders or the beneficiaries of those entities. Those also may not be our client, but it's irrelevant. They're in our files. And the big problem we have when there's an infiltration, yes, we know there's an infiltration. Yes, we know that they went in and they submitted these returns. While that's probably all they did, you can't really most often be sure unless you have extraordinarily detailed logging and a lot of time to go through the logs, which most of the firms that will be infiltrated like this will not have that sort of high-level detailed logging that could tell for sure where, you know, when anybody came in the system, exactly which files they touched, exactly what part of the files they read, exactly what they downloaded. That's a lot of detail that probably isn't being maintained on your network. So the problem is going to become you're going to have to assume that everything on the network was compromised. A second very practical problem, to be totally honest, is that you never quite know that it really ever gets cleaned up or that there might not have put some malware or other options on the system. That makes an infiltration even bigger problem because just trying to assure that your system is no longer infiltrated, has nothing on it it shouldn't have, is not necessarily as simple as you might hope it would be. And that creates some issues for us. So that's a real problem. The preparer in this case now states that even though he only lost 10 clients, it cost him over $500,000 over 6 years to deal with all the costs and expense and other issues that arose from this infiltration. This is a problem because here's the other catch the IRS did this year. If you have done your P10 renewal for next year, you probably noticed that to do that, there was this statement you had to go check a box to agree with and said, as a paid tax return preparer, I am aware of my legal obligations to have a data security plan and to provide data and system security protections for all taxpayer information. Check the box to confirm you are aware of this responsibility. We've discussed earlier in this program about the IRS adding that question to Schedule 1 about virtual currencies. And, you know, your client has to answer that yes or no. Now your problem is, having answered this question, if there is a data breach and you don't have that security document or you didn't take steps that are recommended to protect client data, well, you know, you kind of got a problem because you said in order to do tax preparation work that you were going to take care of those issues. And remember, this is an individual attestation, you're attesting to yourself. This is an individual statement you're making. So you can't say, well, I'm just an employee with a CPA firm that has 200 CPAs, and of course I can't control that, so it's no big deal, I'm just going to check the box. No, you've now got your own personal responsibility to deal with that. You know, it's sad, but true. It's very much like our responsibilities as a CPA under professional standards. Doesn't really matter if the firm does or doesn't provide you with training. You're still responsible to have adequate technical competence for anything you undertake. Same thing here. Regardless of whether the firm itself does or does not actually secure the data properly, you as a preparer essentially have to bail if it's not being done properly, or you may face personal responsibility for having not ensured that you were working inside an environment where the data was properly protected. Now, the IRS suggests you visit the Security 6 list on their website, and in the materials for this week, I have the link to that where you can find the information there. What they suggest you should have in your security systems, basically have considered processes for, are rules regarding antivirus software. You know, you have up-to-date antivirus software on your systems. They also suggest that you should have firewalls in place. Now, note they don't tell us a whole lot about the nature of those. They just suggest you've got to have firewalls. Firewalls can go from the very simple firewalls up to the very extremely complex ones. The appropriate one for your firm is obviously going to be the key here, but make sure you're firewalled, you know, basically at the very least, make sure that you are behind a router. You know, you should not be plugging your machine directly into a cable modem to just be directly live on the net or directly into whatever feed is coming from your internet service provider. You should always be behind a router that is not forwarding the data on to other machines on the network. In essence, make sure you're not exposed. The nature of what otherwise should be done with firewalls or security equipment is much more subtle, and it actually is going to depend on a lot of issues as to what's appropriate for a company, but I'll mention it. Two-factor authentication. I think I've mentioned here before that we've seen studies by major entities, Google and the like, that have shown that if you use two-factor authentication, that can get rid of close to 100% of the phishing emails that attempt to get credentials. Getting those credentials to get into your system is crucial. You should be using two-factor authentication. If your software allows for it, I would suggest that you even have two-factor authentication required to get into the tax program on your network. Some software allows for that, some doesn't. Is it a pain? Yes, because every time the system logs you out, which it has to do now regularly if you're not using it, that's to prevent somebody from sneaking in while you aren't paying attention and submitting those returns. You've got to have two-factor authenticate. You know, you can set up two-factor to get back in. It is a pain, but not that big of a pain, and certainly much better than the pain that, if you want to read that article, talk about what this gentleman went through for having his systems breached. Definitely makes sense. Two-factor is incredibly important. If you have a choice, two-factor should always be not a text to the phone, nor should it be an email to your account. It should rather be something that is a simple straight-off number counting authenticator or a program, you know, something where the third party sends a message to a program that is, or an app that is running on your phone. If you can get to hardware keys, those are even better, but I don't know so far of any of the tax software providers that are using hardware keys yet, so we're still stuck there. Make sure you have backup software or services. That's incredibly important in case of a ransomware attack. Be sure at least some of your backups are offline, because one of the things ransomware is going to try to do is encrypt all backups that are online. So you need to make sure at least some of your backups are moving to offline locations that you'll be able to recover from, not just going to the general locations. Make sure you're using drive encryption when it's available. That's incredibly important. If you're, you know, at this point, given the low amount of overhead that's applied on most modern systems, if you're taking your laptops out to client locations and they're not encrypted, that's a real problem. You know, you should be using encryption. Encryption is built into Windows 10 Professional. You can do it with BitLocker. If you don't have a trusted platform module, it's going to take a little bit of Google work to figure out how to turn it on, but you can turn it on. You should definitely have things encrypted. Your phone should be encrypted. Yeah, you shouldn't have unencrypted data lying around, drives that are encrypted. The big rule is, under these state data breach laws, if the drive is encrypted and you lose the drive, but you don't lose the key, and the other party had no access to the key, then we don't assume the data was read, because breaking the key, if it's good encryption, will be extraordinarily difficult, basically impossible. Could take, you know, what we should say, it could take a few billion years, and that probably isn't going to work for this guy to try to guess your password. He'll move on to a simpler target. Believe me, it's going to be a little bit easier. That's kind of key and important. Also, oh, now to be honest, it only works if you've not done a password that is ridiculously simple for your drive encryption. And also consider the use of VPNs. Important, the VPN they're talking about here is a VPN directly to your network, not really the VPNs you can buy service as a service. Those VPNs don't protect the key problem, which is somebody getting into your system at the office. If you're going to your system at the office, you want to make sure that it's encrypted all the way through. Big caveat, make sure you're not simply opening up a port to use Windows Remote Desktop. That is known to be compromised, and there are ways to get around it. So be very, very careful there. That one was designed mainly for internal work. There is a, if you haven't patched, there's a huge problem right now with Remote Desktop, but presumably if you're on a modern version of Windows, you've patched it. And if you haven't patched that, you've got other issues. But yeah, that's not really ever, it's never been meant, and it's had problems from time to time. If you want to use Remote Desktop, you should be tunneling through a separate VPN back to your network. So that means you got to do something more than pay a third-party VPN provider to provide you with VPN services. Those are great, and make sure the people in the coffee house can't read your data. But eventually it's going to go into the open internet, and if you're trying to get back to your computer, it's going to go in the open out of their servers to your computer. That's not going to be protected under that part of the transit. That's going to be your problem. The IRS revisited the wonderful Section 199 CAPA frequently asked questions on their website. You may remember earlier this year, we discussed the fact that the IRS on April the 11th had posted information to the website, some of which including the self-employed health insurance deduction for S-Corp and shareholders, we weren't terribly thrilled with. Well, they've come back a couple of times. Once they came back to deal with agriculture cooperatives, there's a lot of questions about those that were added. We didn't go over those because that, you know, that's either very, very important to you, or more likely, the way when I talk to CPAs around the country, it never affects you. If it's really, really important, presumably you know that's there and you've looked at it. The rest of the people probably, unfortunately, aren't that concerned about it, so we have to move on. But there is a brand new set of Q&As added on rentals. So they put a bunch of additional questions. 12 questions came up dealing with rental properties. And it's not really anything brand new here. There's nothing terribly surprising in this list. But it's a good place to summarize all the issues because people have been really worked up. And as I've taught courses the past year, I've noticed people have been really concerned, really worked up about 199 CAPA and how it affects rental properties. So this is all the rental rules in one place. It starts with a question saying, how can a rental be a trade or business? And it says basically there are three ways to qualify. It could simply be a 162 trade or business, okay, period. If it's that, it's a trade or business, and 199 CAPA will apply. Secondly, it could qualify, maybe it's not a trade or business, but the enterprise rules will meet the safe harbor of Revenue Procedure 2019-38. And then finally, it doesn't meet the first test, it doesn't meet the second test, but you are renting it to a pass-through entity that's under common control. Under the regulations, Regulation 1.199A-1B14, that's considered to be a trade or business, right? It is often referred to, the fact tell us as a self-rental. That's usually how I hear people refer to the rule. Now, they talk about these issues. You know, they also give a summary of the rental safe harbor, the enterprise and the safe harbor rules, how they work and the requirements involved. Then another question talks about, what if I don't have the records? How do I meet the records? What details do I need? And what happens if I don't have them? They remind you that for 19, they have waived the strict records rule, but you still have to have some sort of support. They've also told you if you don't have records that tie into the requirements for document 250 hours under the safe harbor in 20, you still may very well qualify as a 162 trader business. So, you know, it's not as if you don't have those records, it's not a trader business. Remember, they also remind us in the revenue procedure that even if you fail this test, the IRS could assert you're a trader business. And given the fact that many rentals are lose money every year, it's stuck in passive loss carryovers, and then we sell, we have this 1231 gain that ends up being taxed as capital. That happens, you've got negative QBI. And if you have another, let's say you have a pass-through regular business, well, that negative QBI is going to reduce your income. And the 1231 gain will not reduce your income. It's going to reduce your QBI deduction. Your income is actually going to go up, taxable income, because the 1231 gain being capital will not qualify as QBI. So it's not necessarily a good thing for your rental to be a trader business. And they remind you that you can't get out of it by simply ignoring the problem or saying, oh, I won't keep the records. That doesn't work. The IRS can assert it's a trader business. They also have a question dealing with the mixed-use property special rule we've discussed. It's in the RevProc. So you want a review of that. That's there pretty much summarized. You know, they then come on and deal with a couple of issues. Like, first issue we always run into, and people always get this, well, if my rental's a trader business, do I owe self-employment tax? The IRS reminds us that rental of real estate generally is not subject to self-employment tax. Now, if it's a hotel or that sort of structure, then yes, self-employment tax, because that's not considered a rental. We have exceptions for what's rentals. But generally, if you've got a single family home and you know, you got a single family home that you're renting to one person who's got a year lease, yeah, you've basically got a rental that's not SE tax. Maybe it's a trader business. We've talked about the Fackler and Hazard cases here before. And fine if it is, but it's not going to mean you're going to pay SE tax. That does not have it. And you do not report on Schedule E. You report it on Schedule, or you don't report on Schedule C, I should say. You report it on Schedule E. It goes on E whether it's a trader business or not. They also gave us some information about you can aggregate rentals, right? As long as it's a trader business, we can aggregate our rentals. That's going to be fine. We can use the aggregation rules. It reminds us again the passive activity tie-ins. You do not need to materially participate to get the 20% deduction. But if you have a loss from rental this year and it's not allowed to be a deduction due to the passive activity rules, then that any negative QBI tied to that loss will also not come into calculation this year. It'll be carried forward to future years when that loss is finally released under the passive activity rules. Question 56 deals with something, and it actually gives you kind of a non-answer. Do I have to file information returns if I say my rental's a trader business for 199 Cap A? And the answer is, well, it's not totally relevant. The reason why is because, remember, we had three ways of being a 199 Cap A trader business, only one of which was we are a 162 trader business. The other two was the safe harbor, which could make us a trader business even when we're not. And the third way is if we're a self-rental, which also could make us a trader business even though we're not. To have to file 1099s, we have to have a real trader business. That means 199 Cap, that means a regular trader business. We came in under the first category, not two or three. Now, let me be clear about this for a second. It's not as if you qualify for the first category and you say, but I also qualify for two, so I don't need to file the 1099s. No. If you would meet the first category, let's ignore the other two. If you meet that first category, regardless of whether you meet the other two, that's still a trader business. And if you're paying over $600 to an unincorporated entity, not using a credit card to do so, you're going to have to file those 1099s. In fact, I have in our materials, I have quoted directly from the preamble to the final regulations that basically tells us we need to be consistent. and comply with the information, you know, return filing requirements under 6041 if we're claiming it's a trade or business under the standard 162 rules. That much is still required. The IRS also gives us a rather helpful discussion about triple net leases in question 57. They note, the mere fact that you've got 42 triple net leases does not mean you don't have a trade or business. They do reiterate that they don't believe a single triple net lease is likely to be a trade or business. But again, if you have enough of them and they're under your control, you probably have a trade or business. The one caveat, please remember, you have to test for trade or business at the 100% control entity level. So if you have 42 triple net leases you're managing, but they're in 42 separate partnerships where you're the general partner with different partners in each one, you still got a problem because each of those 42 is a single triple net lease. That single triple net lease will not rise to a trade or business, and you can't aggregate because you can only aggregate if trade or businesses escape from the pass-through entity. So that's still a huge problem. We don't have a fix for that. And finally, they discuss some issues about renting to related entities. That's that whole self-rental rule. They remind us that if we rent to a related entity and that related entity is a specified service trade or business, under the crack and pack rules, that taint may come back to us wholly or partially. So you have to worry about that under the regulations. They also remind us that under the final regulations, if that related entity is a C corp, the self-rental rules don't apply. They say, but you still might have a trade or business if you otherwise qualify for one. It's not as if renting to a C corporation wouldn't create a trade or business, but you have to show you meet the 162 trade or business requirements. The problem we tend to have there is for renting to a related C corp, we're often doing so under a triple net lease, which means we're not going to have a trade or business. That's going to be our problem. The IRS Treasury Decision 9884 issued on the 26th of November. You may be saying, how can that be? I'm listening to this before November 26th. Well, you could be if you listen to it before Tuesday. But here's what happens. They publish them on Friday. And then they tell us the scheduled date it will appear in the Federal Register. The official date is always the date it appears in the Federal Register. It is scheduled to be published on Tuesday the 26th. I suspect it will be published. There's only been one case we know of. You know, there's only one case I remember where it didn't get published, and that was because when the current administration was coming in, there were regulations that had just recently been dropped out on the partnership audit rules. They hadn't gone final yet, as often happens. New administration says no new regulations. So even though we got a look at them, they went back away and they stayed hidden for like over 6 months and then came back out with very few changes. So in any event, assuming that doesn't happen to these, we should have final anti-clawback regulations. And the issue is, right now we've got, you know, an estate or gift tax exemption that is, you know, will be 11.58 million next year. But in 2026, we go back down, and instead of using 10 million as our inflation adjusted number, we use 5 million for the exclusion. So that's going to drop it by about half. And so the problem is, what if I gave away $11 million today? I die in 2026, and when I die in 2026, you know, the exemption's back down to 6 million. There's 5 million that would apparently be taxable on the 706 because I'd still put the whole $11 million in there as lifetime transfers, but my credit's only 6 million. This is meant to solve that problem. There's no major change from the proposed regulations issued in November 2018. Generally, your exclusion amount's going to be the greater of the exclusion amount in the year in question when you die, or it's going to be the exclusion amount in place, or it's going to be total gifts, the total amount of gifts you made during your life that were taxable gifts that were offset by the exclusion amount in place at that time. So in my example, I gave away $11 million. That's totally offset today by the exclusion. So my exclusion amount when I die in 2026 would be $11 million, not $6 million. I'd be able to use that. It also clarified that if you have a married couple, one of them dies during the period we have this higher amount, the other one survives past 2026. That increased exclusion amount that was in place when the first spouse died stays in place. It's not going to be, as some had been concerned, that it would be the lesser of the amount they chose, the amount that was elected, or the amount of the total exclusion that would be available in the year in which the second spouse dies. So we get to keep it. And finally, they also have a discussion of the generation skipping transfer tax and how it applies. They do say they're not ruling on this here, but they kind of walk you through how it should apply if you're concerned about the higher GST that would apply today and what happens, you know, later on after we go past this. Does that somehow get recaptured? And the answer is basically no. If you have used the higher GST amount this year, you know, you say you assigned 11.58 million GST exclusion to the GST trust, then we're not going to worry about that when, you know, if the trust makes distributions after 2026, that somehow that exclusion would be reduced. That's not the problem. Okay. Final case, we have the case of Wilson versus United States, case number 2:19CV-05037 for the United States District Court for the Eastern District of New York. The actual opinion was issued on November the 17th. And this deals with a taxpayer, kind of interesting. He transferred assets to a foreign trust because he thought his spouse was likely to divorce him. Turns out he was right. She was going to divorce him, so he had trusts on the offshore account to make it difficult for her to get a hold of them. Now, what happens is, because he has an offshore foreign trust, he has filing requirements to have to file a Form 3520. He was both the owner and the beneficiary of the trust. Every year until the final year of the trust, he filed the 3520s. In the final year, divorce was all done, everything settled. He takes the distribution from the trust. He takes all the assets from the trust. And, you know, but he fails to file a 3520 either as owner or as a recipient of a distribution from a foreign trust. The IRS comes back and says, well, you failed to do it. We're going to go for a 35% penalty on the distributions, which was, of course, the entire balance in there. He took everything back out. The taxpayer said, I don't think that's right. You only file a single 3520 if you are both the owner and the beneficiary. And the district court agreed. There's only a single 3520. The district court, also looking at the statute, said, in the case where you're an owner and beneficiary, their reading, the court's reading of the statute is the owner rule trumps the beneficiary rule. Under the owner rule, you'd pay a tax of a penalty of 5% on the balance in the trust at the end of the year. Of course, since he had distributed everything at the end of the year, there was nothing in the trust. So the IRS had two problems here. They ruled the 5% penalty was the only one they applied, so it's down from 35 to 5. And then the court also noted that because that applies on the end of your balance and there's nothing there, well, we got a problem. Now, the taxpayer had also argued for reasonable cause. And in fact, interesting part, while this case is pending, he dies, so it's his estate that's actually litigating this. And the court never got to reasonable cause. That could have been interesting as to whether they would have given reasonable cause. And the IRS pursuing this one's also interesting because he had filed every year. He'd reported all the income. Nobody was suggesting that he hadn't picked up what he should have. And the IRS was aware of this trust. It seems to me the IRS was somewhat aggressive here, but that's also a warning to you. The IRS seems to be getting aggressive in a lot of areas where it seems like, you know, fairness might have said that they should be a little more lenient in their enforcement. They appear to be extremely aggressive. We also had the discussion in the past about, you know, the failure to electronically file returns on a preparer not being reasonable cause for the taxpayer. We've had a tax court judge already say that, you know, that seems like counterproductive for the service to go down that road, but the law seems to support them. In this case, law didn't support them, at least in the view of this district court. But be aware, the service appears to be very, very aggressive on penalties in certain areas. So don't assume that you'll be easily get your way out of it. It appears they're pushing. Well, we are here in the fall CPE season. As I said, I'm doing firms, and you know, I do firms in-house. If you're actually thinking about it right now, it would be very difficult, at least for the end of the year, to get in. Might have a chance in January, but that would be it. But after doing that, I also have, though, all the CP we're going to be doing in, you know, for various people, for the state societies at locations. So you want to check your calendars and check your state CPE societies for what's available. I'm going to be doing a couple of them here in Phoenix that I wanted to mention to people because it's both available here from the society and as a webinar. On December 16th, I'll be doing Arizona Accountancy Ethics in the morning, and I'll do the Arizona Income Tax Update and Overview that'll go in the afternoon. Those are both 4-hour courses, so you can sign up for one or both. with the Arizona Society. And if you can't make it to Phoenix office of the Society, you can always take it as a webinar. So if you have interest in either one of those, like you're licensed here in Arizona, so you need Arizona Accountancy Ethics, because you got to get the Arizona style course, it has the right things in it, you can sign up there and you can, you know, take it under that method. This is a one that has tax emphasis. That's our goal in this course. And what Arizona taxes did will be involved there too. On December the 17th, I'll have the full day, 8-hour current federal tax developments. We'll talk about what's happened in the tax law through the end of that, through basically that date, which is getting awfully close to the end of the year. So, you know, we'll see if we have other regulations that are out by then. So you can sign up for either one of those, Arizona Society of CPAs website, ascpa.com. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments. You can catch my updates online at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle there is @edzollers. I follow discussions on the Connect sites for Arizona Society, Minnesota Society, and New Jersey Society of CPAs. I also follow the Tax Talk discussion group for Cal CPA. So if you're involved in any of those, you can check in. You can also check the Reddit site, taxpros/r/taxpros. I look in there from time to time to see what's been going on, and I may respond there. So those are good places to get some information from other practitioners. Well, we look forward to what happens in the next week. It is Thanksgiving week, so there may not be a whole lot happen. The IRS may take the week off, or they may sneak something in Wednesday afternoon. We never know. But we'll keep an eye on what's happening. I'll let you know if there's anything of developments that happen next week. Enjoy your upcoming Thanksgiving vacation, and get ready for that final month of tax planning. And we'll be back here next week